A slave named Dredd.
It just arrived with a large lot of Virginia Negroes, consisting of plantation hands, blacksmiths, house carpenters, cooks, washers, and ironers, seamstresses, and house servants. The undersigned will be receiving fresh supplies during the season, which he offers for sale for cash or approved paper at Higgins' old stand, corner of Esplanade and Moreau Streets, New Orleans. John B. Smith.
$25 reward. Ran away or stolen on the 5th of September, the dark Griffin girl Priscilla, or Celeste, about 5 feet 2 inches high, 24 years old. She has a scar on her right collarbone from a boil and scars on both legs from a burn. May go to Arkansas, where she formerly belonged. Any person that will deliver her to the undersigned or give such information that will lead to her recovery shall receive the above reward. All persons are cautioned against harboring under penalty of the law. John Charlton.
$100 reward. Run away from me, my slave, John. He's 17 years old, 5 feet 8 inches high, slender and awkward. Long, narrow face, sharp chin, mouth small, lips thick and not well closed. He has blue eyes, sandy hair, and inclined to curl only. His complexion so fair as to be generally mistaken for white. He has SL on one side and VE on the other side of his face, picked in by Indian ink. He said he would remove those letters, which will leave sores or scars on his face.
Since the signing of the Declaration of Independence, the country had compromised on the issue of slavery.
When the country expanded westward, so did our compromises.
The first major compromise was the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, which defined the process by which the Ohio territories would become states. One of the provisions in the Northwest Ordinance was the prohibition of slavery.
In 1820, the Missouri Compromise further delineated a balance between the North and the South.
It called for the admission as free states all land within the Louisiana Purchase, north of the line 36 degrees 30 minutes.
Territory south of this line would be admitted as slave states.
The Compromise of 1850 admitted California as a free state and allowed for the newly organized territories of New Mexico and Utah to decide the slavery issue by popular sovereignty, that is, by the votes of those living in the territories.
The Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854 allowed popular sovereignty to determine whether Kansas and Nebraska would be admitted as free or slave states. This redefined the Missouri Compromise because both of these states are north of the 36-degree line.
In 1856, a mini-civil war raged in the Kansas Territory between pro- and anti-slavery forces.
This christened the region Bleeding Kansas.
On March 6, 1857, the United States Supreme Court attempted to provide the ultimate solution to slavery in the territories.
With this case, the Supreme Court also definitively decided the fate of one man and his entire race.
There is little known about this man. He was very dark-skinned and was slight of frame.
He was married for over 20 years and had 4 children, 2 sons who died in infancy and 2 daughters.
He could not read or write and signed his name on all legal documents with a mark. He was a slave, and his name was Dred Scott.
In 1834, Scott was taken by his owner, an army surgeon by the name of Dr. John Emerson, from St. Louis, Missouri to Rock Island, Illinois.
Slavery was prohibited in Illinois by the Ordinance of 1787.
In 1836, Scott followed Emerson to Fort Snelling in the Wisconsin Territory.
Here, slavery was prohibited by the Missouri Compromise.
Emerson died in 1846, and Dred Scott soon sued for his freedom, claiming that he had become free by living in both a free state and a free territory.
For the next 11 years, a legal battle raged between Scott and the executor of the Emerson estate, John F.A. Sanford. Eventually, the case reached the United States Supreme Court.
Soon, news of the court's decision was dispatched to newspapers across the country via magnetic telegraph.
The opinion of the Supreme Court in the Dred Scott case was delivered by Chief Justice Taney. It is a full and elaborate statement of the views of the court. They have decided the following all-important points. First, Negroes, whether slaves or free, that is, men of the African race, are not citizens of the United States by the Constitution. Second, the Ordinance of 1787 had no independent constitutional force or legal effect subsequent to the adoption of the Constitution and could not operate of itself to confer freedom or citizenship within the Northwest Territory on Negroes not citizens by the Constitution. Third, the provision of the Act of 1820, commonly called the Missouri Compromise, insofar as it undertook to exclude Negro slavery from and communicate freedom and citizenship to Negroes in the northern part of the Louisiana Cession, was a legislative act exceeding the powers of Congress and void and of no legal effect to that end.
Soon, people throughout the country were reacting to the court's decision.
Lucy Stone said,
"And when the Dred Scott decision springs upon us, and half the nation stands aghast, tell your household what will be the result, and the smallest child can comprehend you."
Senator Stephen Douglas said,
"Chief Justice Taney and his associate judges require no eulogy, no vindication from me. They are endeared to the people of the United States by their eminent public services, venerated for their great learning, wisdom, and experience, and beloved for the spotless purity of their characters and their exemplary lives. The poisonous shafts of partisan malice will fall harmless at their feet, while their judicial decisions will stand in all future time, a proud monument to their greatness, the admiration of the good and wise, and a rebuke to the partisans of faction and lawless violence."
Frederick Douglass said this,
"In one view, the slaveholders have a decided advantage over all opposition. They are organized, and yet were not at the pains of creating their organizations. The state governments, where the system of slavery exists, are complete slavery organizations. The church organization in those states are equally in the service of slavery, while the federal government, with its army and navy, from the chief magistracy in Washington to the Supreme Court, and thence to the chief marshalship at New York, is pledged to support, defend, and propagate the crying curse of human bondage."
"In this country, the law is the will of the people, embodied and expressed according to the forms of the Constitution. The courts are the tribunals prescribed by the Constitution and created by the authority of the people to determine, expound, and enforce the law. Hence, whoever resists the final decision of the highest judicial tribunal aims a deadly blow at our whole republican system of government, a blow which, if successful, would place all our rights and liberties at the mercy of passion, anarchy, and violence."
"Neither in the preamble nor in the body of the Constitution is there a single mention of the term slave or slaveholder, slave master or slave state. Neither is there any reference to the color or the physical peculiarities of any part of the people of the United States. We the people, not we the white people, not we the citizens or the legal voters, not we, the privileged class, and excluding all other classes, but we, the people. Not we, the horses and cattle, but we, the people, the men and women, the human inhabitants of the United States, do ordain and establish this Constitution. I ask then any man to read the Constitution and tell me where, if he can, in what particular that instrument affords the slightest sanction of slavery.
Here we present an article entitled, A Visit with Dred Scott, based upon how it appeared in one of the most popular periodicals of the day, Frank Leslie's Illustrated.
We finally reached a wooden house. Approaching the door, we saw a smart, tidy-looking negress, perhaps 30 years of age, who, with two female assistants, was busy ironing. To our question, is this where Dred Scott lives?
Yes.
Is Mr. Scott at home?
What white man added that nigga for? Why don't white man tend to his own business and let that nigga alone? Some of these days, they'll steal that nigga. That a fact.
A man then appeared in the doorway.
It okay?
Oh, Mr. Scott.
Yes, sir?
I have a letter of introduction from your lawyer. We found Mr. Scott on examination to be a pure-blooded African, perhaps 50 years of age, with a shrewd, intelligent, good-natured face, of rather light frame, being not more than 5 feet 6 inches high.
What the white man come out of that nigga for? The devil is at the bottom of all of this.
Madam, we don't wish to carry off Dred, but merely to carry off his daguerreotype.
It okay. I knows it's all right.
I don't know that there's any harm in a daguerreotype. But I know the white man did want Dred and was trying to get him away. That some gentleman had promised to give Dred $1,000 a month if he would travel to the North. That the people wanted to see him. But I always been able to earn my own living, thank God, and earn an honest one. And I didn't want money gotten that way. I don't believe any good would come of it. 'Twas the devil's work.
Perhaps Mrs. Scott would be willing to sit for a picture?
Oh, I don't want to make Tom fool of. Besides, how could I have a daguerreotype when I wasn't fixed up or nothing?
Dred Scott, as might be supposed, is quite a humble, but nevertheless a real hero, moving about the streets of St. Louis. He employs himself in carrying to and fro the clothes his wife washes, and waiting, as opportunity offers, upon gentlemen at the hotels. His wife, very much younger than Dred, is neat, industrious, and devotedly attached to her husband and children, an acceptable member of the church, and would evidently be satisfied with obscurity and repose. Dred did not appear to be at all discouraged by the issue of the celebrated case, although it doomed him to slavery. He was evidently hugely tickled at the idea of finding himself a personage of such vast importance. He does not take on airs, however, but laughs heartily when talking of...
The fuss they make there in Washington about the old nigger. You know, I could make $1,000 by traveling around telling folks who I is. That is, if I allowed to.
Hence they, the Republican or Abolition Party, argue that any law or regulation in violation of this fundamental principle of Negro equality with white men is not only cruel, inhuman, and infamous, but is subversive of the foundations of the government itself. If we grant the truth of their premises, it would be vain to resist the force of their reasoning or the correctness of their conclusions. Indeed, we would be compelled, as honest men, to acknowledge and adopt the principle and carry it out in good faith in all our political action. We shall certainly be compelled, as conscientious and just men, to go one step further. Repeal all laws making any distinction whatever on account of race and color, and authorize Negroes to marry white women on an equality with white men.
Now I protest against the counterfeit logic which concludes that because I do not want a black woman for a slave, I must necessarily want her for a wife.
These are the words of Abraham Lincoln.
I need not have her for either. I can just leave her alone. In some respects, she certainly is not my equal. But in her natural right to eat the bread she earns with her own hands, without asking leave of anyone else, she is my equal, and the equal of all others.
The Dred Scott decision in practice, as it appeared in William Lloyd Garrison's paper, The Liberator. Slamming the last door, the gentlemanly conductor of the New York train made his appearance with his bow and smile.
Tickets, gentlemen, if you please.
Seated in the front corner and surrounded by her personal conveniences was a colored lady by the name of Dinah.
Ticket, Mom?
Says our conductor with a civility regardless of complexion.
I hasn't got 'em, but I've got money anyway.
And she began to fumble in her bag, then in the bundles, searching these articles through in vain.
Come, hurry up. I can't wait all day.
Bless your soul. You don't think I find everything in a minute. But I've got money somewhere. Must be in this here carpet bag.
Well, well, I'll pass through. And when I get back, perhaps you'll have it ready?
Yes, Sutton.
But as he passed along, she reached out her umbrella and giving him a poke upon the shoulder, asked,
What you gonna charge on freight?
Freight? What do you want to know that for?
'Cause I does. I'm civil, ain't I?
Well, 5 cents a foot. There, don't bother me anymore. But find the money.
There seemed to be a peculiar drollery about the lady's eye and mouth as the one rolled around in its black sea of flesh and the other opened to give vent to an involuntary. It was not long now before she found her purse and withdrew some coins. In due time, the conductor returned for his money. And upon extending his itching palm, was somewhat astonished at receiving the precise sum of 10 cents.
What do you mean? The fare to New York is $5.
Yes, yes, I knows that for white folks, folks what am folks. But I's nobody. I's afraid I is. Yeah, yeah. Poor rule is don't work both ways. 5 cents a foot. Heyday is.
The nonplussed functionary stood undetermined for a moment until an idea of compromise occurred to him.
Well, if you're afraid, take yourself off into the baggage car.
But even there, Dinah was too much for him, as she replied.
Just you pick up your freight if you want to carry him off. Lord, rest that a preem court and get him credit for $5 bill anyway.
Prices of Negroes. Number one men from $1,300 to $1,400. Number one girls, field hands, from $1,100 to $1,200. Boys from 12 to 15 years of age, $1,000 to $1,200. These prices are for Negroes free of defects and sound and healthy. At the present time, however, it is safe to say that Negroes, good or bad, command all their worth.
Remember that while your foot is on the cradle, it is on a source of power stronger than his who casts the ballot. And standing in that place of responsibility, let no hour pass without deepening in the minds of your little ones the impression of hatred, of a system out of which comes the Dred Scott decision, a system which makes politicians of every school toadies, and the descendants of the fathers of 76 unworthy of the manhood that ought to belong to them in the midst of the revolution that is now upon us.
The following appeared in the Charleston Mercury.
The Supreme Court of the United States established as law what our southern statesmen have been repeating daily for many years on the floors of Congress. At the whole action of this government on the subject of slavery for more than a quarter century has been all beyond the limits of the Constitution, was without justifiable authority, and that the whole mass should now be proclaimed null and void, and that slavery is guaranteed by the Constitutional Compact. It appears that we, secessionists, have been all the while not disturbing the law, not intruding novelties upon the country, not seeking to break up established principles, but that we have been simply a step in advance of the highest tribunal in the country in declaring what was the law of the land and seeking honestly and faithfully to enforce it.
With an earnest, aching heart, I have long looked for the realization of the hope of my people. Standing, as it were, barefoot and treading upon the sharp and flinty rocks of the present, and looking out upon the boundless sea of the future, I have sought, in my humble way, to penetrate the intervening mists and clouds, and perchance to descry in the dim and shadowy distance the white flag of freedom, the precise speck of time at which the cruel bondage of my people should end, and the long entombed millions rise from the foul grave of slavery and death.